We will kill a hostage if our demands are not met.
We can't give them what they want, I'll tell you that much.
It's down to the negotiators to break the deadlock, or your men will have to storm the embassy.
Press are everywhere. Do not let them make you.
Do authorities face terrorism with negotiation or force?
Shots fired in the embassy. Get set.
Keep Salim talking during the assault.
You want me to help kill them?
I want you to save the hostages.
The Prime Minister wants the world and the British people to see how this government deals with terrorism.
It was April 1980 when armed gunmen stormed the Iranian embassy in London, taking 26 people hostage. Kate Adie was the BBC journalist on duty when, after 6 days, the SAS went in to break up the siege. She reported from behind a car door as smoke bombs exploded in the background and soldiers abseiled in to rescue the hostages. For Kate, it was the start of a distinguished career as a war correspondent, covering conflicts around the world, including Libya, Afghanistan, Tiananmen Square, and the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. New Zealand director Tor Fraser has made the story of the Iranian embassy siege into a film with Abby Cornish playing Kate. It is screening at the International Film Festival, and Kate Adie is in New Zealand to support the release. She's in the studio with us this morning. Kia ora and welcome to New Zealand. I'm just, hang on a second. There you go. Your microphone should be on now.
Right, thank you.
No, sorry, that's my responsibility. Can you perhaps start by taking us back then, what is it, 37 years to the siege in London, for what, for you as a journalist, was a first big break. But can you just describe to me that environment in which you found yourself as a reporter?
It was a time when there was a lot of terrorism. We had Northern Ireland going full blast. I had reported a lot of that. But we had daily problems, incidents in London. There were Middle East terrorist organizations and across Europe as well. It was a very, very busy time. And when this incident first kicked off, we thought, just here we go with another, this'll be dealt with. You know, they were usually over quickly. But this was different. And we got a call saying there's trouble down at an embassy near Hyde Park. So we went down there. And right at the beginning, we got right in front of the embassy. Police were milling around. Nobody seemed to know what to do. The door of the embassy was shut. And the first thing that really occurred to me was that when I finally got onto the office, and I mean finally, because take a deep breath, this is a time when there are no mobile phones. There are no satellite dishes, there are no iPads, there are no computers, nothing. So to get the news back to the news desk, I first went looking for a public telephone box. You know, I'm a national television reporter at the time, and that's what you had to do. And there were so many hacks queued round it, trying to get on the telephone and give their sort of little snippet to their newsrooms. I then went back to our crew car, and we had a very wonky kind of two-way radio, which never worked quite properly, and through the broken sounds through the air, I managed to say to them, it's all happened down here at the Iranian embassy. There are hostages inside. And a voice said, Iranian embassy. And I heard someone say, sort of off phone, did we send somebody? Where did those two guys go this morning from the newsroom to get a visa? Where? The Iranian embassy?
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy. And I ended up going, you're not going to believe this, but...
Wow.
And they were inside. I mean, that's so unusual with a big news story that suddenly you find close colleagues, people I worked with on a daily basis, were actually part of the story.
Yeah.
That was just the beginning.
When we think about these big events now, I always think of the police or whatever authorities are trying to take charge at the time as setting up a huge cordon and no one can get within several kilometres of the event itself. But this was a time before that sort of management when reporters were allowed relatively close. And you were so close.
I think it was because there were so many incidents. I remember going to suspected bombs in Oxford Street in London, you know, the big shopping street.
Main Street.
And really, you cleared people back maybe 200 yards. That would be it, really. You couldn't afford to clear the whole place, you know, in the sense that there were so many. Most of them were, in fact, false alarms. But every so often, something... You know, in came the army, tried to defuse this and usually managed it. But it was also in Northern Ireland where we all operated. We were actually used to hearing the Northern Ireland police say to us, who were fairly laid back about life after years of troubles on the streets, who used to say, you just want to walk down that street. Well, I can't guarantee I'll come to your funeral. Yeah, that was it, you know. And yeah. you sort of took your own sort of measure of how seriously they were all taking it and got back behind them. But there was less of a sort of, people were just used to it. I know that these days we live in troubled times and there are dreadful incidents, and by heavens we've had them in Europe. And just this week there in Australia is another little emanation of this, which is all coming out of ISIS in the Middle East. Even so, it's not quite, I have to reassure people, as intense as it was in the sort of late 70s, 80s. And that was the time when the Iranian embassy siege began.
As a reporter now, when I go out on a story, and for my years in New York, it was always the case. If I had to go out on a story, I had to fill out a detailed health and safety form. I would have to identify the hazards I was likely to encounter, whether they be riding on a subway, driving in a taxi, working by myself, working late at night. These were all hazards that I had to identify. I am presuming that such forms did not exist.
Absolutely nothing like that. Health and safety was not even spoken about. I take the view that we didn't live and do things more dangerously at all. Somebody showed me last month the health and safety booklet that now exists in my old organization, which I now freelance for. It's 56 pages of it. I'll tell you what really gets my goat. There are two things. First of all, we should all be responsible for being common sense and nouse. Filled. We should actually look after ourselves. And in the ordinary events, it's different when you go to a place where there's huge conflict and lead flying and everything. That changes things. But here, like a lovely city like this one, and in London, you really just have to be a grown-up. Mm. And the second thing is, I feel this so strongly, there's so much in all of this sort of business about being sort of frightened and risks and take care and all of that. That awful American phrase, take care, after a conversation, as if, you know, you're going to sort of walk a tightrope. And the point is, hey, out there, 99.9% are great people.
Yeah.
Friendly people. They're not an enemy. And that's, as a reporter, I think, terribly important to remember. And I've been in dreadful, dreadful situations where people have been killed, where people are still killing, where people are absolutely off their heads with rage or fear. Even amongst all that, you will find human decency. People will help. I've been in appalling situations. I only survived in 1989 in Tiananmen Square with my crew and all the streets round about where their Chinese army was massacring its own unarmed people. I only survived because ordinary Chinese, people totally unknown to me to this day, grabbed hold of us, whisked us round a corner, hid us from the secret police, showed us where we should go. And I owe my lives to those wonderful people. And I actually think that the world is full of good people at a greater number than those who are not good. And all the health and safety, the risk bit, hey, as a reporter, out you go to find out what a wonderful world it is. It may be grim stories and bad stories sometimes, but most of the time, wow, what a wonderful, interesting world it is to be a reporter in.
I remember being a little boy and watching coverage of the Siege of Sarajevo, and I wondered if you would pinpoint a time or a conflict when life as a war correspondent changed, in that you had kind of been in a position whereby you weren't targeted necessarily.
It's never been the case.
Never been the case?
There's never been a golden age. No. Look, the first person...
Because it was clear in Sarajevo that reporters were targeted.
Ah, but they have been always, and if not actually by the enemy, their own people. I'll give you the example of what we always call in Britain our first modern correspondent at a war, and that was William Howard Russell, who went off to the Crimean War in the 1850s. And he was keen to use the latest technology, which involved the train, getting his story back, and also pigeons, carrying news. He was very convinced that he should get his information back before the war was over, which was the usual way for the centuries up till then. He had a sense of urgency, particularly because he went to the Crimea, which, you know, Florence Nightingale came out a short time after him. And the point was, he saw the most appalling way the British army was being run, that more people were dying of starvation than of enemy wounds. So he wrote this and sent it straight back. Everybody coughed over their breakfast in London and they read this and they said, this is disgraceful. And the British Army general said, this man's here. Go find him. And one said, let's shoot him. I mean, the sense that people have reported war and it's always been benign and they've always been welcomed, even by their own side, is just not true. And the idea that reporters, and I hear it from people today, think that you live in a kind of neutrality bubble of the press and sort of glide around between the various factions saying, no, no, just, you can't shoot me, I'm a journalist. It's never been like that, ever. And I think you have to remember that in times of conflict, quite a lot of the time, particularly in a civil war, where the lines are blurred and families are against family even, that people are so frightened, so furious, so despairing, they'll attack anyone. So as a journalist, you should never presume that, you know, you're going to be seen as a good guy, you know, popping from one side to another. It's never been like that.
How many times have you been injured in reporting?
Well, I've fallen over a lot of things.
Well, put that to one side.
Yeah,
have you been injured by somebody else,
well,
purposefully?
Because I was saying you fall over, you have accidents, particularly if you're running like hell and you're fearing for your life and you're in a place you don't know and the place is full of wreckage. You can really do yourself in. I mean, that's the most common thing that happens. I've been very lucky. I've been grazed 4 times, and I have some shrapnel in my foot still. Hello, shrapnel. It's down there. Come out one of these days. And I've been very lucky, very lucky. But you don't go to get injured, and it's bad news if you are, because you don't want to be part of the story. You know, you don't want to be anything which holds up the actual reporting or even causes trouble for other people around you. You're there to get the story, not to get involved.
Yeah.
To be a witness and not to be part of the story.
I want to ask you about your thoughts on the situation in the Middle East at the moment in a couple of minutes. If you're able to stay with us, Kate, that would be wonderful. Right now, it's 20 past 10. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Jack Tame with you in the chair through to midday, and my guest this morning is the legendary BBC correspondent, Kate Adie. Kate, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts of the Syrian conflict, regarding the Syrian conflict at the moment. First of all, from a geopolitical perspective, what will bring this conflict to an end, do you think?
I don't know precisely. What I tend to see it in is sometimes as you do as a journalist, which is historical terms, that you've got a big divide within a religion which crosses several nations and several different cultures within the Middle East. And that's exactly, it is exactly the same as happened in the early Middle Ages in Europe, where along came Protestantism, the Reformation, and an enormous divide in what had been one Christian religion in Europe with the Catholic Church. And the wars went on.
So Islam is at war with itself?
It is in many ways. And the two big countries which matter are not the ones which are directly seeing violence at the moment, such as Syria and Iraq and Yemen and Libya, where there are wars. Dreadful things are happening. It's the two big boys. Iran, which is Shia, and Saudi Arabia, which is Sunni. That's the real problem. So you watch those two. It's awful to say it, but what's really going on at the moment is that both Iran and Syria are fueling the wars by being proxy warriors. They're feeding money, they're feeding soldiers, they're feeding equipment. All of this is going on. But if the two of them have to square up or decide to, then we really are going to see something awful. So that would be my thought, because it's very difficult to finish wars. Normally you do it just by physical aggression. You beat the others. This is ideology. These are two branches of religion which at the moment in much of Islam do not agree. And they're not going to agree because they think they have the God-given right to their own view of it.
Does the world care enough? And is it the media's responsibility to make the world care more?
It isn't the media's responsibility to make the world care. It's to make the world aware. That's the important thing. For the media to us, not to forget it, not to push it into a corner and say, anyway, I don't think our audience understands it. I don't think that's the right thing to do. It is hugely important, not least because there are ghastly situations already where ISIS has done the most unmentionable stuff to thousands of ordinary people. Dreadful, dreadful cruelty and torture. Disgusting stuff. The suffering of those people matters. In Yemen, there are starving people now, and there is also disease because of the terrible state. Libya is in chaos. It matters that we bring that to the world's attention. Now, it's not, I don't think, for anyone's media to cheer on a government or the military in any country to go do something. It's advocacy is not, particularly, I suppose, in the kind of broadcasting I've been in the BBC, has never been our line. But there is very definitely, I think, a responsibility to say, we ought to take notice of this. Because I tell you a little story from Sarajevo. At about sort of a year into the major, major fighting all over former Yugoslavia, I got into Sarajevo as the trouble was just really taking hold with the Serbs surrounding Sarajevo. Mainly,
coming through the tunnel? Or?
Yeah. Well, no, that wasn't even built then. Right. This is early on. And we were in Sarajevo, and I was with a colleague from British newspaper, Robert Fisk, who was one of the more dynamic, piratical people in the great journo. And one morning, I was literally crawling around the area around the National Library, which had been set on fire. It's a marvelous repository of fantastic literature and an archive. It was going up in flames, and the Serbs had targeted it. And there was sniper fire, because it's only a few hundred yards to front line. All of that. And Fisky grabbed hold of me. He said, "Follow me, follow me." So I did. And we got to a street corner. We were near the river, which was really seen as the de facto front line, because it was open ground between that and the snipers at the other side. And he suddenly dropped to his knees and then, like a frog, hopped along the pavement on all fours and then crawled. And I went, "What?" And he said, come on, follow me, follow me. And I crawled down the pavement after him, and we got, not, it was only about sort of 50 yards, we got to the corner and there was the river, open fire. And I said, "What are we doing here?" He said, look beneath you. And where my hands were, I think. And there was a paving slab, and on it were two concrete footprints. And I said, "What?" He said, "Guess who stood on those? Guess who is on that spot?" 1914.
The Archduke.
It was Gavrilo Princip,
the assassin.
Gunman who assassinated the Archduke a matter of feet away on the corner, in an obscure little part of Eastern Europe, which nobody took any notice about. Who's the Archduke? Nobody's ever heard of him.
Yeah.
And he shot the Archduke in Sarajevo.
And World War One
began. And it's that kind of thing where you say, so you've never heard of the Yemen? You don't know what's going on there? You really don't know the difference between Iran? So does it matter? I always think back that moment in 1914, and that was the spot. And meanwhile, war was raging round us.
Mm.
It matters, covering these things.
So what do you make of the coverage then? And the job journalists are doing.
It's hugely difficult. I mean, all Western media have got a problem. There is less money around in both America and in Europe, and particularly in Britain. Newspapers have closed. There is fewer people on the reporting staff. The media, the television people are having difficulties. And, of course, there is competition from the internet with a different kind of news. All of this is going on. Added to that, the kind of threats that ISIS have delivered are really on a much greater scale than many other conflicts, where they have announced they won't just not tolerate journalism, they will hold, torture, and kill in the worst possible manner anybody they think they don't like, and that includes journalists, and they've targeted them, and they've done that. On top of that, these days, with the interconnected world, they then use their videos. Your government at home gets embarrassed by this. Why did that guy need to go? Look what that position has put us in. The whole thing is a nightmare. It's understandable that there is diminished coverage. That doesn't mean you ignore it. What I would have done was put reporters on the borders, on the areas where people are going into these places. I would interview people on a daily basis who are coming out from the hell of being under ice. I think you can do more. But limited resources, and it has to be said, audiences who go,
show me the next conflict.
Exactly. It's worrying.
It's such a pleasure to speak, and I'm very sad because I feel like we could speak for hours. We haven't touched on a Mr. Trump, a Mr. Putin. We haven't spoken of refugees flooding across Europe. We haven't talked about Brexit, and we could go for hours.
But you must also say there's a great New Zealand film.
Oh, of course. And we didn't even finish up.
And it's terrific. And I dare say this now. I've seen it twice. And I have to say, last night, you could hear a pin drop during the whole of it.
Really?
The audience.
Is it true to your experience?
It is. There's tiny little tweaks there. And there, you know, like they're always saying, I remember it that way. No. But
there's not a Sandra Bullock, Hugh Grant love story intertwined
in the middle.
Do you know,
that's the sort of thing that I worried about when I was first approached. I thought, are you going to have me sort of fall in love with the policeman who's on the SEA? For heaven's sake, it's absolutely true to life. Yeah. And it's very true to life. There were bits of it where I thought, ooh, that was just how it was. Yeah. Absolutely so. And it's the real deal. It's the real deal.
Well, it's a great pleasure to speak. Okay, thank you so much for joining us this morning. 6 days we'll be screening at the New Zealand International Film Festival on the 8th and 9th. So that's what, Tuesday and Wednesday of this week in Wellington. Kate will be there for a Q&A with the audience. I can imagine the Q&A will last longer than the film, to be perfectly honest. But enjoy your time in New Zealand, and thank you so much, Kate.
Thank you.
That is Kate Adie.